It's that peppy little flute there again, the recorder. It's 5 minutes after 10 o'clock on a Monday, signifying that it's time for the Daily Connection here on KDOV. And it's a real treat to have two pals here in the studio and two guys who really love history, church history especially, and that's Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, both on the staff at Trail Christian Fellowship. And we enjoy once a month a little chat about things that are kind of appropriate to the season. Well, today we're going to do a seasonal conversation. It's about the Puritans, looking ahead to Thanksgiving. You know, we owe a lot to those guys as Americans, and I think as probably believers as well. But what do I know about Puritans except that they came from, well, England or through Holland? I don't know. But that's why you guys are here today.
That's right, Pat.
Help me out, guys. The Puritans, they're a mainstay of our Thanksgiving celebrations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Pat, the things that we have to share today about the Puritans and about Thanksgiving, in essence, most people know the story. And in essence, the story, for the most part, is pretty much true. You know, the Mayflower came mm-hmm. over here full of the Pilgrims. The Pilgrims were seeking religious freedom, amongst many other things. They had a hard winter. We know the story. The Indians helped them out. They had a Thanksgiving feast in November, by the way.
Yeah.
And actually, it was October, late October. So Canadian Thanksgiving is actually closer to the real date of the Mayflower Pilgrims. But that's the story we all know. But, you know, in reality, probably even as exciting as the Thanksgiving story is really the prelude to the Thanksgiving. What happened that set this whole circumstance in motion? That is an interesting story in and of itself.
Especially to us as Christians.
Absolutely. One of the things I just want to help people to kind of place the Thanksgiving story in a timeline related to the things we've been talking about in months past. The Pilgrims and that first Thanksgiving feast sits exactly 100 years after the Reformation.
Wow.
And exactly 100 years before the Great Awakening, which we spoke about last month.
You know, it's really interesting, Pat. This one of the things that Christopher and I love is we're forced in this program to take really complicated movements and flows of history and reduce them into basic sound bites, and that's really good for us too in our concepts, like the 100-year bookend thing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! Well, just to give everybody one a real simple background on this, you all remember the Reformation and Martin Luther nailing his theses up. Now, primarily, the Reformation came about as a reaction to the abuses of the established church and the hypocrisy of the established church. And where this comes in important is that Luther and Calvin and most of those early reformers, they sort of took the personal experience of Christ for granted, and they focused primarily on doctrine issues, on liturgical issues. And that was okay, except over the next 100 years, actually, the intellectual end of things, doctrinal, liturgical, tended to push the personal experience of Christ sort of to one side. And by the 100 years later, when the Puritans began to develop, it had really come to dominate everything. And that was one reason the Puritans did develop. They were very, I better touch on Henry VIII. Everybody knows the story. He wanted to get rid of his wife, Catherine of Aragon, and so he decided, well, I'll just bail on the Roman Catholic Church, set up my own church, and get my own way. And basically,
so it's sort of like early church hopping.
Yes, actually. Early church hopping.
Don't like the way things are going? We'll just start our own.
That's church. What he did, by go. Golly. And it worked for him. And he had, I hate to say bad things about Henry VIII, but he was not a really spiritual guy. And his ends were primarily just worldly. Mm-hmm. And he ended up having 6 or 7 wives. And most of the folks that follow, his daughter, Mary, came to the throne after his death. She tried to get things back under the Roman umbrella and acquired the nickname Bloody Mary in the process. She only lasted a few years. Then Elizabeth came, and she was just interested in practical politics. She said, okay, let's keep the Church of England. That's what we've got. Let's just make this boat float. And this went along fine, but there was a growing dissatisfaction among God's real people in England and Europe, but we're focusing on England, because really it was just the Catholic Church under another name. They had not changed really any of the practices. They just, instead of Rome, it was London. And the people that were really seeking that personal experience with Christ were growing more and more restive. And what this did, this this resulted in the rise of what were called the Puritans, people that were looking to purify the church of too many empty rituals. They really wanted the personal experience. And to make things even more convoluted, you basically had two kinds of Puritans. One, you had the dissenters who thought, well, we're going to change the Church of England from the inside, you know, no matter how long it takes. And eventually, these are the guys that ended up fomenting the English Civil War 50 years later. Oliver Cromwell chopping off King Charles's head. It really became quite a nightmare.
Wow.
Well, we're not dealing with them so much. We're dealing with the other set of Puritans who became known as the Separatists. They looked at the situation and said, you know, this is just not going to fly. This dog's not hunting. We're going to bail. We're out of here. We're going to set things up on our own. And those are the folks that comprised our little group of pilgrims.
And they went over, and they basically had to escape. They wanted to leave, and the king said, you're not going to leave. And they actually almost, you'd have to say almost under cover of darkness, had to escape to set up their own little colony over in Holland. And they went over to Holland because Holland was a bit more tolerant of different religious views. And they lived there for about 12 years. And actually, the funny thing is, of course, is that they went over to Holland because of toleration, but Holland was a fairly inhospitable place to them. They were tolerant, but they were also, because of their tolerance, were fairly lax spiritually. And this, the Puritans found a little disheartening as the new generation coming up began adopting some of their practices. And they said, this isn't the kind of place we want to raise our sons and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was is the fact that the economic situation was so harsh in Holland that the immigrant pilgrims, that's what they were immigrants there, they were reduced to doing some of the lowest forms of labor. And these are very intelligent people. People that were not on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum in any way, shape, or form. And they were reduced to a very low form of making a living. Sometimes the entire family had to work just to make ends meet there. And so after about 12 years, they begin to realize we need to find another place to live. This isn't cutting it for us.
So they're English citizens. They're living
English
in Holland. They're working hard, but it's a bad situation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that a lot of people misunderstand. There's the idea they fled England and came to America. Well, that's not really true. They did leave England, but that was more of a port of debarkation. They decided out of their group that was living in Holland that they were going to send about 60 people over to the New World, if that was possible, and begin a new colony, and then the rest would follow. And so they sent their representatives over, and they hired the Mayflower. And the Mayflower was a hired boat that they took to the New World. And
the English boat? Dutch boat?
Actually, it was a Scandinavian boat, if I remember. It did a lot of trade in Scandinavia all over Europe. And they also had petitioned, by this time, King James, the King James we know from the King James Version of the Bible. They petitioned him for an official charter for them to set up a colony within the new American colonies. And he said, well, I'm not going to give that to you, but I'm certainly not going to stand in your way if you guys want to move over there. In other words, he said, I'm going to basically turn a blind eye.
So and by now, there were a little more favorable attitude here to them in England?
It not really. No, not really. They were really on the outs. As a matter of fact, the only way that they were able to get the ability to live in the state of Virginia, or the colony of Virginia, was to basically become part of the London, Virginia Company, and they had actually sold themselves kind of into an indentured servitude for a period of 7 years to get over there. And so finally they get their right to move in and live on the lands of the London, Virginia Company. They hire the Mayflower, and they depart in the fall of 1620, the 1620 on the Mayflower. Couple things I want to say, though, that's interesting, because I think it's essential in understanding the prelude to this story is 5 years before the pilgrims leave, two things happen in the New World that really set the stage for their survival. And we can almost look at this as the hand of God working behind the scenes in this story. One of the things that happens is the Indian tribe, the Pawtuxet Indians, that lived in the Cape Cod area had a terrible plague that struck them and basically wiped them out almost to a man, as a matter of fact, to a single man. And that single man actually was kidnapped by some English seafarers, and taken over to Spain.
And now, that's the only reason he survived.
That's the only reason he survived was 2 years prior to the plague. He gets kidnapped by these English seafarers, and they take him to Spain and sell him into slavery.
This is cool.
And he escapes the slavery in Spain, makes his way to England, where he learns English, and then eventually makes his way back to the New World. And we know this Indian by the name of Squanto. If you've ever heard of Squanto the Indian.
Later, he signed a contract with Walt Disney to make that film.
Great. You know, there's a guy that wrote a book on Squanto. I heard about him on Breakpoint. I'm going to have him on the show Wednesday.
Oh, awesome. You bet.
So Squanto's the guy, when you have the picture in your mind, when you learn in grade school about, you know, how the Indians helped the Puritans to plant the corn with the herring and all that stuff. That was Squanto that did that. Okay,
amazing.
He's the guy that taught them how to survive on the new land. But also with the Pawtuxet Indians becoming completely wiped out by this plague, the local Indians around that land, their tribal land, which just happened to be where the Mayflower landed, they thought that land was inhabited by evil spirits and didn't want to go near it. And so the pilgrims actually had land that they didn't really have to fight for to get or to conquer any Indians to get, because the Indians didn't want that land. And some interesting things happening, of course, behind the scenes there.
That is amazing. I never... Well, that's great.
Well, you know, it's fun because as we were doing research out there, actually, as my brilliant daughter-in-law, Jessica Orman, was doing research for us, went out and found a whole bunch of information how the pilgrims had exploited the Indians and everything. And this is just not the case, Pat. Their relations with the Indians that were their neighbors was marked by honorable treatment, equitable all around, became friends, rescued each other many times from natural disasters and common enemies.
They even had a treaty with the Indians signed. It was a treaty to help one another. If the Indians were getting beat up on anybody, the pilgrims would come help them. If the pilgrims were getting beat up, the Indians would come help them. And so in that first generation,
it was a good deal all the way around.
Real good friendship and amicable relations.
Well, as a matter of fact, the whole Puritan thing, I mean, H.L. Mencken, the journalist author from the early 20th century, once said that Puritanism is the nagging suspicion that someone... somewhere
is having a good time.
And I hate to say it, this is really the take that the American education system has put on the Puritans. And it's a real lie. It's a real ripoff. The whole Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know, in The Scarlet Letter,
right.
Gosh, that's taught as literature. And the bum deal that comes from that is most of us end up with a really distorted picture of who the Puritans were. Or Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, about the witch trials. And boy, if that's all you know about the Puritans, you are way, way out to lunch. We kind of joked about them being the closet party animals last month, and that was a jest, but there's some truth in that. They're not the folks in the black clothes that we like to say. They like to dress in colors. As a matter of fact, they got in trouble with the Quakers, I think, because they liked lace and ribbon and a few decorations on their clothings. They liked to party. They liked to, gosh, I think they actually drank more rum per capita than the average European. So these were not, you know, if you read their journals and their diaries, these were not the hypocritical people that Nathaniel Hawthorne was putting out. He had some bad times with his Puritan parents. And
they might have had such a good time. The pilgrims might have had such a good time that they wouldn't be welcome in today's church.
Yeah, possibly. Well, you know, because they were not as interested in the outward manifestation as the inward experience.
Hmm.
Now, to be honest, they did. They were very disciplined. And so they were really careful. They thought, okay, a real walk with Christ is going to produce fruit in a person's life. But if you read their journals and their diaries, a lot of humor. They were very comfortable with their sexuality in marriage. None of the prudish stuff that we think. It's a real eye-opener if you get to looking at it. Well, what they did, they thought they were creating a city on a hill. They were trying to create something that had never been done before. It was an experiment. Now, they weren't, this is an important point, they weren't out to establish the United States of America where there would be freedom of all to worship. That was not their plan. They were looking for a place where they could worship in their way. And as a result, that was part of the trouble they had with the Quakers and later with the witch trial, which was kind of, they got a little crazy, and even all of the surrounding Puritans in the surrounding colonies were a little angry and upset with what had happened in Salem. I just, as an aside, do the real research on that to find out what really happened. But these were folks who were primarily interested in really coming up with a real walk with Christ. They'd had enough of the hypocrisy. They'd had enough of the ritual. They wanted heaven on earth. And as a matter of fact, came up very close with that. It was a real hard-working, industrious city and colony.
And, you know, one of the things that I think that most people have a hard time realizing is the fact that the pilgrims' thought life and their view of the world truly is flowing through our veins even to this very day.
Mm-hmm.
The concepts of rugged individualism, hacking a land out of the wilderness, these things are very much our legacy from the pilgrim people.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of self-determination and self-government, the idea of freedom under God, and all these different things that we take for granted are actually very new contributions. And the reason for that is in the context, they were not trying to transplant the old world into the new world, but were trying to create something that had never existed before. And the reason that the United States of America today is so different from our neighbors to the north and to the south of us is because of that very reason, because they had that concept of wanting something new.
So we make fun of a parody which has grown up in America of the Puritans, and the reality of the situation is that our foundations are based on what these folks did. Not only, as Christopher says, in the whole self-determination thing, but oh my goodness, their emphasis on education. I think it was like 11 or 12 years after Plymouth Rock. I mean, they're still living in mud huts when Harvard was founded. And not too long after that, Yale. These guys really took education seriously. They really wanted their ministers to be incredibly educated. As a matter of fact, I was interested to find that Yale and Harvard were the only two universities in the Western world at that time which required Hebrew.
How about that?
You know, you could go to Vienna or Berlin or London or Oxford and get away with no Hebrew, but not in the backwoods of America, by golly. You better know your stuff.
And also the contribution of the Puritans to preaching.
Oh, goodness, yes. That was their media. I mean, that was the preaching was, they took that to a new art form. As a matter of fact, we still use that today, don't we, Chris?
Very much so. Their form of reading the scripture and then talking how it relates directly to your individual walk. I mean, these things are standard procedure.
Every church in America.
In our country mm-hmm. today. And how do we base what a good sermon is how relevant it is to us. And they would think nothing. They would think nothing of a 2-hour, 3-hour sermon because that was vitally important. And they loved to have a sermon every day and they liked to read sermons. And they were quite a literate group of people, very well educated and very literate and very thoughtful.
Sounds like a whole bunch of C.S. Lewis type folks.
They've been described actually as a group of married monks and nuns, a community. They were that serious about their faith. As a matter of fact, if they just plopped down right here, we would find them gravitating in this day and age towards positions of honor and leadership in our church. They were just gnarly. And very sincere. None of the hypocrisy that we've been told. None of the, you know, well, sure, occasional individuals, but as a community, they were extremely admirable and really worked out a living faith that they spoke about.
And that, of course, brings us then to that famous day that we celebrate every year around this time.
Absolutely.
Thanksgiving. And Matthew and I were discussing this prior to the program and really have come to the conclusion that Thanksgiving today has some incredible parallels with the Thanksgiving of the first pilgrims.
Yeah.
Take, for instance, the fact that at the first Thanksgiving, there were 140 guests. Now, these were Englishmen and Indians. And yet, out of the 140 guests, they leaned on 9 women to prepare all the food. Now, tell me how that has changed.
Yeah.
Isn't it always just the few women in the family that have to put together the entire feast?
We're thinking of you, sisters.
Golly. Then, of course, we have, Sue's giving us the 2 thumbs up on that one. Then, of course, they had the old Thanksgiving turkey, but they had a bit of a broader menu than we had.
Didn't they have the Thanksgiving eel?
They had the Thanksgiving eel, the Thanksgiving clams, they had the Thanksgiving venison, and then, of course, they had cornbread and lots and lots and lots and lots of wine. And they had quite a celebration. It lasted 3 days.
Now, was this one year after their arrival?
Yes, was celebrating the very first year. As a matter of fact, they actually may have ate a bit too much because they had overestimated how great their provisions were. And
went back to starving.
The following winter, they kind of had a rough time getting through because they'd eaten so much.
Well, none of that. I think they established also the American tradition of athletic contests on Thanksgiving.
We have televised sports happening on Thanksgiving Day, which is an integral part of the Thanksgiving celebration, is eating until you're stuffed and then watching, you know,
football
of some kind. Mm-hmm. And they didn't, of course, have televised football programs back in those
days. But Miles Standish would march his army up and down of 14 guys, and they would do some musket drills and
archery
Indians.
Contests, yeah. And really? Indian wrestling and singing and dancing. And so they had kind of their own sporting events as well that went along with this. And
were the Indians part of it?
The Indians were
very
much part of it. They were... Quite frankly, they were good friends and got along very well and hung around together. And so this was just a big joyful thing, and I think a wonderful legacy even down to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so in many ways, I think probably the only way that it's different is the fact that they were able to get together with all their neighbors and with their friends and get along for 3 days, when in fact... we can't seem to get together for an afternoon with our relatives and get along sometimes for even the afternoon. So maybe in one respect, the Pilgrims had one up on us in the old Thanksgiving department.
You bet. Know. But when everybody's around the table this Thanksgiving with their feet kicked up and their bellies chock full and they're watching football, just remember, you're carrying on an honored tradition.
Honored
of
time
good
tradition.
Christian American ethic.
Well, it seems like Thanksgiving and 4th of July, for me, are kind of the two American holidays, you know.
And do you know that also 4th of July, we celebrate the 4th of July almost to the letter how President John Adams suggested that we celebrate it.
Blowing
he
up
said,
a lot of things?
He said blowing up fireworks, having picnics, eating potato salad, and...
A parade?
Parades, and we do exactly what President John Adams prescribes.
Always liked old John.
We do a good job on the few holidays we celebrate around this country.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna have to read that book. I'm sure you guys probably will too. That John Adams book, it's just out. But anyway, a minute left, and you guys, I thank you for setting the record straight on the Pilgrims. Of course, they are admired forefathers of this country, and it's great to know their heritage spiritually. Their love and their joy of life, and certainly things did not go well after that first year. There was a lot of starvation going on.
They had to pay a
terrible price. But are there some good sources that you would recommend?
We were buried, Pat, and to be honest, you don't have to go far without finding sources. No one source that we found, but there's a ton of it. Just got to dig a little bit to find something that's not... the product of someone's political agenda.
Wasn't there, you know, I think, I actually have on my shelf, I've not read, Robert Bradford, was it John Bradford? There was a Bradford there.
Yeah, John Bradford.
The history of the colony, 1620, 1630.
And he was quite a historian as well, as a matter of fact, quite a reliable historian. And that's where we get a lot of the information about the Pilgrims. And he was a very well-learned man, and a lot of people debunk what he said.
Always, you know, when you're reading history, read the source. Read the guy that was there and did it, and not the commentator afterwards. Read the real thing. Well, thank you, Matt and Chris, once again. A great program.
To do it.
Thanksgiving here, celebrating the Puritans, getting a good... Matt and Chris are on the staff there at Trail Christian Fellowship. And right now, I invite you to stay tuned for Charles Stanley with In Touch. Pat Daly here. Lord bless you today.